Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with hopeful signs of a thaw in the intractable relationship between the United States and Iran, following encouraging words from Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, who said his exchange of letters with President Obama has been positive and constructive. Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi joins us to discuss Iran's behind-the-scenes brokering of the Russian-American deal on Syria and to analyze the new tone ahead of Rouhani's visit to New York next week. Then we'll examine the bankrolling of the radicals in the House of Representatives who have steamrolled their leadership into agreeing to shut down the government unless Obama's signature achievement that was voted into law and upheld by the Supreme Court is defunded. Zephyr Teachout, a professor of law at Fordham University and the former national director of the Sunlight Foundation, joins us to discuss the role of the Koch brothers in turning the Tea Party from a populist movement into a congressional caucus of strident shills for right-wing plutocrats. Then finally, we will assess the impact of the Pope's remarks that the Catholic Church is obsessed with abortion, gay marriage, and contraception and should not interfere spiritually in the lives of gays and lesbians. Marianne Duddy Burke, the executive director of Dignity USA, the leading organization of LGBT Catholics, and Francis Kissling, the former president of Catholics for Choice, join us to discuss how Pope Francis's words might translate into action. And joining us now is Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi. His latest book is The Rise of the Pasdaran, which is about the social, political, and economic roles of the guardians of the revolution in Iran. And his most recent book is The Cultures of the Middle East. He contributes to Jain's Islamic Digest and Jain's Intelligence Digest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rasul Nafisi.
Thank you for the invitation.
And the new president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, is coming to the United Nations next week to speak to the General Assembly, but he gave an interview to NBC News, which is getting, I think, a lot of fairly positive response. And since he got elected, he's also been getting a lot of, positive press and saying things that seem to be certainly a change from Ahmadinejad. So let's start with that question. Given that the ultimate power in Iran is with the supreme leader, is this a new face, a friendly face on the same regime, or is this a regime change?
No, it's certainly the friendly face of the regime, because Rouhani is an inside person, and he's been with the security forces of the Islamic Republic from day one. And so he is absolutely an insider. However, he's different from many others in terms of maintaining a certain level of independence. And we know from his book, which is sort of diary of his activities in the area of nuclear security and so on and so forth, that in 2003, he was able to convince Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader, to come to a certain understanding with the West and strike a deal. And he was able to shut down, actually, the nuclear activities to a certain level. So Rouhani is different in terms of the amount of power and knowledge he has, and not only from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was psychologically challenged, but even from Khatami, because Khatami did not have that kind of personality and even knowledge. Bear in mind that Rouhani has a degree in law from Tehran University and also has a degree or PhD in constitutional law from a certain university in Glasgow. So he seems to be a knowledgeable man, and especially his pick for foreign department is Mr. Zarif, who is an excellent diplomat. And I think the combination of the two would be really magnificent, because If you look at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the past, it's been led mostly by radicals, and now you have a very moderate, very Western, highly educated and Western educated, he's a U.S. educated man in charge. So I think the team is magnificent. However, there's a caveat. Since I've been watching Iran for the past 35 years, and even though I wrote my doctoral dissertation about Iran, Iranian Revolution, I have been witness of several ups and downs. And normally, when optimism rises and everybody says, well, this time something good will happen, and everybody is braced up for good news, something terrible happens and it stops everything else. In terms of the emergence of Rouhani, Zarif, and their goodwill and all the associated good news with that, I'm not confident that the Russians, Arabs, Israelis, even in Turkey, would like to see the Iranian position buried off in terms of relation with the West. And then, of course, they have influential people inside the country. And again, inside Iran, I'm not sure that the IRGC or the Guardian of Revolution is quite happy to see a rapprochement with the West. So, yes, to answer your question, it is good news that this team is up. It is good news that the better face of the regime is up, and it's certainly not the regime change. But to what extent they can really further their agenda, I'm not quite sure about that.
Again, I'm speaking with Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi. His latest book is The Rise of the Pashtun, which is about the social, political, and economic roles of the guardians of the revolution in Iran. And his most recent book is The Cultures of the Middle East. He contributes to Jain's Islamic Digest and Jain's Intelligence Digest. But still, just in terms of good news, releasing 12 political prisoners, which Rouhani promised to do, that clearly is the good news, particularly for those who were released. A very prominent human rights attorney. She's out of jail, already giving interviews to the BBC. And then you've got Mohsen Aminazadeh, who is a former deputy foreign minister under President Mohammad Khatami. And he, of course, supported the candidate Mousavi in the elections. Of course, he was prevented from running and is, still under house arrest. So it'll be interesting to see whether they get released from house arrest. But what struck me most, apart from his statements about Iran not wanting a nuclear weapon, which frankly is not new, they've been saying that for a long time, and we just simply don't want to believe them. But now maybe we'll believe this guy because he seems like a decent guy. But what I thought was interesting that he said, Rasul, was about the internet and wanting Iranian people to be completely free and have access to information and the right of free dialogue and the right to think freely is the right of all people, including the people of Iran. Now, that, of course, is not necessarily being translated into reality. The internet was open for a while for Facebook and then suddenly shut. So what do you make of that and where does that stand?
Rouhani has made a lot of progressive statements throughout elections in terms of what women can wear and also freedom of information and freedom of universities and just about everything that you wanted to hear from a liberal president. And I have seen some of those slowly being watered down. For example, in terms of women cover in public, he was emphatic that we should not enforce it. We should not force the Islamic hijab on women. I said that on several occasions. Now that he's in power, he said to the morality police that, well, don't go to extremes. And it is like any other politician. He made a lot of good promises that you wanted to hear. Now I'm seeing some watering down of the promises. However, he seems to be quite aware of the fact that in the age of freedom of information, you cannot really curtail access to the internet. And if not now, maybe in 6 months, we see a plethora of activities in terms of freeing the internet and Twitter and Facebook and all that. We will see that for sure because he has a power of convincing Ayatollah Khamenei, as we know, because of what he did in 2003. Now, I'm very hopeful that he can manage some good deeds in the coming 6 months. And he would be a far cry from the radical, fanatic, and occasionally lunatic band of people that were helping Ahmadinejad and Ahmadinejad himself. So it's a great news to have him, but I do not discount the power of forces that are against any kind of liberal activity in the country. IRGC at the center of it.
That's the Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
They really don't want any change in the status quo. And a great number of clerics who are very afraid of any sea change in the country. And they look at the freedom of information as the key to social change and political upheaval. So he will have a very rough time make any changes in the country. But remember, he is an insider. He comes from the security forces. He knows a lot of people. He has worked with a lot of people. So I think he can pull a lot of positive levers and make a country a little bit more livable, especially at this time that people are facing so much hardship because of inflation and unemployment. So,
but that's a result of Western sanctions.
Oh, certainly. And mismanagement by Ahmadinejad. Let's not forget about what he did. He basically shut down the organization of planning and budgetary, which really was the think tank of all the experts. And then it started to throw money away. There is a statement by one of his, ministers who said, sir, you're promising so much money to each and every province. And it seems that you know of some money and some income that we are not aware of. He said, well, the 12th Imam will emerge and he will fix it.
That's the Messiah, right?
That's the Messiah. That's right. The Messiah of Shiites, right? So this is the type of guy you're talking about.
It'd be like having the Reverend Pat Robinson run the United States, right?
Or a little worse, I would say. Okay. Because Pat Robinson even has a certain level of rationality in him.
Right. Well, he certainly likes the money.
Sure for that.
So let's turn, though, to the obvious here, and that is we know what happened under the Liberal President Hotemi, in that was he reached out to the West and he was rebuffed. And even then after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the Iranians basically came to the White House and said, everything's on the table. We want to negotiate everything. And Dick Cheney said, we don't talk to evil. And he was hung out to dry. And then the hardliners came in. So that's a long-winded way of saying, unless something is achieved relatively quickly with Rouhani and Obama, and they seem to have started an exchange of letters, which Rouhani described Obama's letters as positive and constructive, right, and he's coming here next week. Do you agree that the U.S. and the Iranians should really, this time around, try and move things along, and because the window can close as it's done before?
Absolutely. We have a very small amount of time. We have a very short time for fixing things and also not losing hope in Rouhani from inside Iran and of course, in the West. And he must do something, and he knows that. He must perform. He must achieve result. And I think Obama administration is pretty much at the same juncture, too. They want something to be done, and they love to see this atomic agenda moving forward. But as I said, the forces that are against it are great and too many. And even I'm not, as you can imagine, a very optimistic person. Even when the dilemma of Syria and using chemical weapons there began, in the heart of my heart, I thought, well, maybe somebody did it to, again, force the United States against the closest ally of Iran and force Iran to do something about it and create another conflict, another round of conflict, and prohibit any kind of advancement in the relationship between two countries. So this is the way I look at the reality of affairs between Iran and the United States. And I certainly hope that this team of Rouhani and Zarif would be able to do something about it. Because Rouhani said, now I have the full authority to make changes in our approach to the West and nuclear policy. And I take him for his words. I hope he can do that. But as I said, there are too many forces against it.
But on the Syrian question, there does seem to be a split in Iran between the hardliners and Rouhani, and particularly Rafsanjani, who made a speech recently condemning the Assads for the use of chemical weapons. And that was posted on his website, and then it was taken down. So something's happening there. They seem to be they're talking about not sending arms, sending humanitarian aid to Iran. My understanding is that in many ways, Iran and the United States are a lot closer on this issue over Syria than meets the eye. And also, you mentioned a lot of people in the neighborhood don't want a rapprochement between the U.S. and Iran, principally Israel, Saudi Arabia. You mentioned Turkey. I'm not sure about that. But, you know, so elaborate on that, if you will, of what happened with Rafsanjani and what's going on with Syria and how much the U.S. and Iran, in fact, have in common. Neither of them want to have a bunch of Sunni jihadis running Syria.
Right. What Rafsanjani said in a speech, and it was immediately denied by his office, reflects the feeling of the pragmatists in Iran. Pragmatists like Rouhani, Rafsanjani, Khatami, and many others are saying, look, we have to look inside. We have to stop adventurism outside. We don't have any fight to pick with Israel. That's what Rafsanjani said a couple of months ago. We have no fight with Israel. And they are thinking of just putting a stop to all this adventurism, support even for Hezbollah and others, and start, you know, developing the economy back home, which is in a terrible shape, and the government is bankrupt, doesn't have any money. The oil export is dropped to half, and simple things, simple necessities and food stuff is becoming kind of scarce in the country. So they are putting emphasis on the home front. But on the other hand, you have the IRGC, you have the radicals who are looking at Syria as the line of extending the power of Shiite radicalism all the way to Mediterranean Sea. And Taib, one of the radical clerics, said that in a couple of months ago. He said, Syria is our most important province, even more important than Khuzestan. And remember, Khuzestan is the province of Iran that produces all the oil in the country.
Right.
So to them, Syria, the line to Hezbollah, all of this adventurism outside the country is central to their agenda. But pragmatists like Hashemi Rafsanjani are coming to the conclusion that they better look back home and do something about the misery that is engulfing Iran.
Well, I think it's fair, though, just that perhaps something will happen next week at the UN with Rouhani. It seems like he's laying the groundwork, and these letters with Obama and the positive vibes back and forth. Just in closing, though, Rasul Nafisi, what's your sense of whether or not the Syrian situation is going to torpedo things? Or, I mean, there was somebody, I can't remember who it was, had this theory that Syria could become Iran's Vietnam, that they'll just get bogged down there. It sounds like you're suggesting that's not happening, but there are constituents inside Iran that want to double down. What's your sense in the long run as this U.S.-Russian deal takes place? It could become a model for a U.S.-Russian deal to work on the Iranian question as well.
Remember when Secretary Kerry made a statement in France about the likelihood of coming to peace with Syria if Syria got rid of its chemical weapons? In passing, he said that. And you made it almost impossible, said in 1 week. the country that picked on it was not Russia. It was Iran. Iranians immediately talked to Assad and said, this is a good deal. And they got his agreement, and they immediately went back to Putin and said, look, we cannot announce this because nobody likes us in the world. Why don't you go ahead and make it your agenda and your plan? And Russians accepted that, and they said, well, that's a good idea. Let's do it. And to me, this demonstrates the fact that Iranians are quite aware how dangerous Syria is becoming, and they don't want to have any increasing factors or wars in that country. And certainly, they don't want to be involved. The reason I'm saying they don't want to be involved is because the theory back in Iran is U.S. and the West are using Syria to lure Iran into Syria, and they make it a pretext for attacking Iran. So they are very careful about it. So whether it can become an Iranian Vietnam, I am not quite sure.
Well, I've heard that too, that that's been a strategy, at least amongst hardliners. But it doesn't seem to be the case at the moment. It seems to be heading in a different direction. And I thank you so much for joining us here today, Rasul Nafisi.
You're very welcome. Enjoy the discussion.
Again, I've been speaking with Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi. His latest book is The Rise of the Pashtun, which is about the social, political, and economic roles of the guardians of the revolution in Iran. And his most recent book is The Cultures of the Middle East. He contributes to Jain's Islamic Digest and Jain's Intelligence Digest. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Koch brothers' role in funding those who want to shut the government down. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Zephyr Teachout, who is a professor of law at Fordham University and a board member of Public Campaign Action Fund and Fight for the Future. Previously, she was the national director of the Sunlight Foundation and director of online organizing for Howard Dean's presidential campaign. Welcome to Background Briefing, Zephyr Teachout.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
And clearly, there's an intent on the part of the House Republicans to shut the government down over Obamacare, and then they have a second bite at the apple over the debt ceiling as well, where they may well tie the Keystone Pipeline. But the initial crisis will happen very soon, apparently, where they will vote down Obamacare for the umpteenth time.
Right.
The Senate will strip it out, then it'll go back, and then we'll see what happens. And it seems that Bain has caved and that the Tea Party caucus is running the show. Is that your impression?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's a combination of two different things that are going on here. One is a reflection of a genuine public distrust of government. Sometimes I think of it as a kind of nihilism. It's a distrust of everything. And then the bigger part of it, and I think the far scarier part, is the big money behind it. So these two are blended in really bizarre ways, and ways that are sometimes really hard to entangle. I mean, if you look at the Tea Party, I actually followed the Tea Party pretty closely when it first started, and there were all these different stages of Tea Party activism. The first stage was this anger at the bailout. And that anger, I went to some Tea Party events then, that anger was a blend of different kinds of anger. Some of it was a really populist anger that became, over the next 6 months, taken over in various ways by a bunch of corporate interests. So it starts out with a sort of anti-corporate soul in some cases, and in some cases an explicitly racist component too, depending on the state, and ends up with a far stronger corporate funded component. So it's a really a sort of distressing masking of a genuine public uprising with funding.
Well, the Tea Party Revolution started out of the outrage over the TARP fund.
Yes, exactly.
Quickly was politicized in the sense that they went, unlike the Occupy movement that eschewed political representation and the democratic process, they got 65 congresspeople elected in 2010, and now they're controlling the House. But to a man and a woman, they are absolutely faithful servants of the Koch brothers and the plutocrats. That's where I don't know whether the Tea Party rank and file know they've been had.
Yeah, there's also a change. I mean, I always object a little bit to the language of the Tea Party that we all use now, because we have an image of those early protests and of, you know, perhaps people still meeting weekly in small bars or coffee shops in Montana. As I watched the movement, what you would see is early on there were pretty regular meetings. It was sort of a not just grassroots in the sense of polling, but grassroots in the sense of ongoing activism. But quite quickly those meetings dissipated, as it did with Occupy as well, so that there are not the regular kind of rank-and-file Tea Party coffee clatches that there were in the early days.
Well, it does seem that the fingerprints of the Koch brothers through Americans for Prosperity, and now they have a new front group to try and shut down Obamacare, and it's called Generation Opportunity, where they're basically telling young people you're better off not having health care coverage and insurance, and in fact, they call Obamacare a Ponzi scheme, and they're pouring money into that. More recently, the recall of two state senators in Colorado over a gun control bill that they had signed on to, that was, it turns out, largely funded by the Koch brothers, and the accounting can't be done. I mean,
yeah.
You've got the mayor of New York putting in $350,000 of his own money. That got headlines, but the fact that the Kochs spent more money and had a ground game with thousands of people putting flyers into people's mailboxes, that didn't get any coverage because, guess what, Citizens United basically allows them to spend unlimited monies without attribution.
Yeah, and there's this recent reporting on the fund Freedom Partners, which is established as a business league organization as opposed to a 501c3 or 501c4, it's 501c6. And the recent reporting suggests that it gave more than $250 million in the 2012 election cycle, putting it, you know, second only to Karl Rove. Freedom Partners is closely aligned with the Koch brothers. They certainly are diverse in the way that they do political funding. I mean, one of the things that really strikes me about the Koch brothers is that they engage in across-the-board kinds of political activities, including investing in universities, including in investing in this youth group, as you talked about, including in recall efforts in Congress. I will tell you that the new case that's coming before the Supreme Court on October 10th becomes more troubling if you look at it in light of the Koch brothers. This case, McCutcheon versus FEC, is a case where there's a challenge to aggregate limits on contributions to candidates and parties. So right now, there's a limit on how much you can give a candidate, but there's also aggregate limits. So you can only give, you know, wait for it, only give about $124,000 over any given cycle to all different candidates or parties. The challenge is that there should be no aggregate limit. You can still leave the individual limits. Well, if the Koch brothers have no limit on how much they can spend in direct political contributions to candidates, party committees, we're going to sort of only multiply the problem.
And again, I'm speaking with Zephyr Teachout, who's a professor of law at Fordham University and a board member of Public Campaign Action Fund and Fight for the Future. Previously, she was the national director of the Sunlight Foundation and director of online organizing for Howard Dean's presidential campaign. So with the Club for Growth and the Koch brothers' various fronts pushing the Tea Party people, what is their motive in terms of shutting down the government? I mean, do they really want to wreck the government? Because, you know, you've got all these Wall Streeters and the Chamber of Commerce basically saying, for God's sake, don't do this. Don't put the full faith and credit of the United States up for ransom.
Yeah.
You know, it makes no sense to businessmen. So are the Koch brothers such zealous libertarians that they simply want to destroy the government?
Well, I don't know, but my own sort of way to think about the Koch brothers is that we should think about them in more traditional feudal ways, that what they're doing is acquiring power. So if you think of Game of Thrones, what your intuitive response is, well, they're looking for more territory, more power. And, you know, the other sort of traditional explanations are ideology or greed or desire for acclaim. But in this case, it seems that the breadth, the strategy, the way they approach things seems to me more like a marauder taking over a country than it does a capitalist with a disinterest in with interest only in his own pockets or her own pockets, or just an ideologue. I mean, look at Bloomberg. Bloomberg's an ideologue. He has very, very strong views. But he operates in totally different ways. I mean, it's most striking when you look at how the Koch brothers and Bloomberg operate in terms of universities. The Koch brothers have donated to over 150 universities, and they make sure they maintain some kind of power dynamic with those universities, so they still maintain control over the curriculum. Bloomberg tends to donate more ideologically. In the case of universities, he'll donate to his alma mater, and then his other donations are for gun control. But they're not; it's not as strategic, and it's not power accumulating as the Koch brothers, which is why I actually think they're a bigger threat because they're power accumulating than if we just look at them as ideologues.
Well, I was reading some earlier essays that you wrote, Zephyr Teachout, and one where you talked about the Koch brothers and you invoke Benjamin Franklin's written speech at the beginning of the Constitutional Convention, where, quoting Ben Franklin, "Sir, there are two passions which have a powerful influence in the affairs of men. These are ambition and avarice, the love of power and the love of money. Separately, each of these has great force in prompting men to action. But when united in view of the same object, they have, in many minds, the most violent effects. Placed before the eyes of such men a post of honor that shall, at the same time, be a place of profit, and they will move heaven and earth to obtain it."
I love that quote.
Well,
Franklin, he said he was too nervous to give the speech, so he had somebody else read it out loud. And what he was trying to introduce into the convention at the time is he thought offices shouldn't be compensated at all. But he was trying to introduce a kind of psychologism to the convention, that we have to really think about how corruption happens, how people are motivated, you know, what are the emotional forces at work here. And I think he had a lot to say about that.
So is there an analogy between British royalty? I mean, you know, I guess we don't have an aristocracy. We have a plutocracy here in the United States, and the Koch brothers are certainly classic plutocrats. But obviously, a lot of people on the left keep sort of whining, I guess, about why working Americans vote against their own interests. And I'd like to get your version of why you think that's the case.
Oh, just a small question like that.
Right.
I mean, there's so many different things. I guess I'll add something that I don't think is talked about often enough. That I think actually, there are a lot of things that working Americans, public education and education about politics is weak, all these other various factors. But one thing is that I think people are pretty smart, and they are correct in experiencing a loss of power, a lack of a sense of control over their own destiny and their own life. And the right wing, certainly the Tea Party, has a story to tell them about that. And their story is government is exercising this power. This is why you don't feel power. Is that government has taken away your experience of liberty and your experience of power. The left-wing response, or my response, one I think that is extremely important, is to tell an alternate story that makes sense of that lack of power, not just to talk about food, education, roads, not just to talk about pocketbook issues, but also to talk about power in very direct ways. And, I mean, I'd really like to see a return to the antitrust ethos of late Roosevelt through the late 70s, which was a central idea in American society, the idea that you needed decentralized economic power, not necessarily decentralized political power, and you could only have a democracy with decentralized economic power. I think that the left makes a mistake when it engages people only on pocketbook issues and not on their emotional experience of disempowerment.
But also, I think there's a disparity, Zephyr Teachout, in as much as you recall in the last election, Mitt Romney even went so far as to call himself a severe conservative, because conservatives very, very proudly preen and puff their chest out and say, I'm a proud conservative. It becomes a mantra. How many liberals have you ever heard of in government or in leadership of any position stand up and say, I'm a proud liberal, or I'm a proud progressive?
No, there's this learned helplessness, which is just terrible. It certainly helps. So, you know, it's a combination of that, I think, and, you know, this fear that comes from Clinton in many ways and the Clinton response to Reagan. Peter Beinart had a really nice piece about this recently.
Oh, in the Daily Beast. I thought that was very interesting, where he basically thinks that maybe Hillary will be in trouble and that the millennials might well prefer a Elizabeth Warren over Hillary Clinton.
I think there's a lot to that. It's a wonderful piece. And the Clinton sort of fear of liberalism and fear of a certain kind of economic populism that is so trained in a certain generation of politicians. But then there's the money. I mean, we got to be very, very clear about the money. So the financial transaction tax polls incredibly high. But there are not that many entrepreneurs who are pushing it because of real fear of retribution when they run for office again. So, you know, one very clear reason that you don't see the populist message for candidates who might otherwise have it and otherwise be able to connect to voters is because they are so scared of being hit by the Koch brothers or by, financial institutions or political action committees funded by financial institutions. So Bill de Blasio's great win in New York, which I'm very excited about, comes about in part because of public funding of campaigns. So if candidates can be dependent on the public instead of dependent upon hoping that the people who can give $2,600 or spend, in the Koch brothers' case, $250 million and more in an election cycle, we're never even going to hear the populist message. So I think Beinart is right to suggest that the new generation is open to the populist message and the proud liberal message. But you need a public funding system that aligns with that.
But you'd think that populism would be in the zeitgeist. We are in a new Gilded Age. If you go back to the original Gilded Age, with William Jennings Bryan running against McKinley, and then later with Ida Tarbell and Mark Twain, all railing against the banks and the trusts, and they eventually busted up the trusts. And
they did.
And I cannot for the life of me understand why, when we live in a country where the 1% have 40% of the country's wealth, and I think 400 people have half the country's wealth or something extraordinary like that. I know that the one family, the Waltons, have the wealth that's equivalent to the bottom 40% of all Americans. I mean, it's extraordinary how unfair it all is, and yet nobody wants to pick up the ball and run with that, with economic inequality.
Oh, I think there is this. I mean, I think it's just sitting there waiting to be scratched. Actually, I'm working with a couple other people. We just started an organization called the Antitrust League, based on a 1906 organization called the men's commercial workers and hotel union antitrust league. You know, there are all these little groups in the post-Bryan era that were pushing Roosevelt and others to...
Teddy Roosevelt.
To start busting up the trust, which he did a medium job at. I mean, it was really the second... second Roosevelt's term that got more aggressive on trust busting, but certainly passed the Tillman Act, limiting corporate contributions to campaigns. So I actually think we're right on the cusp, and we need to tap into that, and the Clintonian anxiety gets in the way of that. But I'm hopeful that it's about to happen. I think in the initial Tea Party, there's a lot of that, not in the current Tea Party. The current Tea Party is a I think of the current Tea Party as fundamentally anarchists. My anarchist friends don't like that, but they're anti-government in such a fundamental way. But the early Tea Party was more skeptical of power, and wanted some understanding of how to understand TARP.
Well, let's hope that Occupy and the early Tea Party, there's a lot of common ground there.
I think there is. Yeah.
Well, Zephyr Teachout, I thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Ian, I really appreciate it, too.
Again, I've been speaking with Zephyr Teachout, who's a professor of law at Fordham University and a board member of Public Campaign Action Fund and Fight for the Future. Previously, she was the national director of the Sunlight Foundation and director of online organizing for Howard Dean's presidential campaign. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Pope's surprising words about gays and lesbians and the Catholic Church's obsession with abortion and contraception.
It's the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is feminist activist Frances Kissling, the president of the Center for Health, Ethics, and Social Policy and former president of Catholics for Choice. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. And also joining us is Marianne Duddy Burke, the Executive Director of Dignity USA, the leading organization of LGBT Catholics, their families, friends, and allies. She has an article at the Huffington Post, 15 Years in the Lives of a Catholic Lesbian Couple. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marianne Duddy Burke and Frances Kissling.
Hi.
Thank you.
Well, let me start with you, Marianne, since I guess the two things that the Pope said today, the headlines that were made, were both when he referred to the LGBT issues, and then also he also talked about the Catholic Church's obsession with abortion and contraception. So I think the last time we spoke, Marianne, was when the Pope made those off-the-cuff remarks on the plane coming back from Brazil. So bring us up to date on what he said and how it struck you.
Well, he certainly used the interview to expand upon his remarks on the plane back from Brazil. But what I think is most significant here is his comment that the church should be a home for all and not just for a select few, and his calls on the bishops to stop being sort of rules enforcers and to get out among the people and to really live the message of the gospel. I think that sets an entirely different tone from his two predecessors, and maybe we'll see much less emphasis on these doctrinal and moral issues and much more focus on the poor and the sick and the impoverished and, you know, folks who are at the margins of society.
And Frances Kissling, what struck you about the Pope's remarks in the interview he did for the Jesuit magazine America?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the interesting thing is his, particularly his use of the words that the church needs to concentrate less on its rules and more on the humanity and more on people. And that has been the central, really, in some senses, the central problem in terms of the positions that have been taken on women, ordination, gay, LGBT, and reproductive health issues. It's that the rules have always come before the people. And there's no sympathy for the situation of the average person. And as this Pope has made clear, there's this enormous separation where, you know, clergy don't get down among and with the people. So I think that while we're not yet seeing any kind of doctrinal changes or even any real relaxation of rules, I think that he's taking the first sensible step, which may lead to some changes, which is to say that rules are less important than the lives of human beings. And human beings are suffering, and we need to be where that suffering is. So that's what struck me, was his dismissal to some extent of rules as central.
Well, specifically when he was asked, the Pope said, "A person once asked me in a provocative manner if I approved of homosexuality. I replied with another question. Tell me, when God looks at a gay person, does he endorse the existence of this person with love or reject and condemn this person? We must always consider the person."
That's right. And I think that's the same thing. And I think that's the same thing I'm saying, is that historically, it's exactly what I'm picking up on. Historically, one would indeed, and the church would indeed, you know, even though it says it doesn't condemn the person, the church does indeed condemn persons who don't obey the rules. And the first step is to embrace the person, which is what he is doing.
And Mary,
so I think it's a very positive sign.
Marianne, what's your response?
I totally agree with what Francis said, and I think that every LGBT person and family member who reads this statement or hears this statement is going to see that he's really trying to shift the church from a position of, you know, rules come first, to openness, embrace, love, welcome. You know, that change in emphasis and tone is so significant in the lives of people who have known so much damage, so much suffering at the hands of the church, so much demonization and dehumanization at the hands of the church. I also think there was an awful lot in the beginning of the interview where Francis spoke a lot about discernment and consultation as the foundations for change. So I do think that this is really something that he's seeing as a starting point, and that he's signaling that there will be some openness to change. I thought it was also very hopeful that he kind of really addressed the issue of the critics head on. I mean, he said, you know, there are those who are saying, "I'm not talking enough about abortion," for example, you know, but this is where we need to be. We need to be starting with people out among folks who are disenfranchised, who are suffering, and that's where the church is called to be. I mean, he took that on right away, and I think that was very courageous and really set a tone about who's in charge in the church now.
And Francis Kissling, former president of Catholics for Choice, I've often been puzzled as to why we don't refer to the Catholic Church over the most recent decades as being, in effect, captured by fundamentalists. And we do, obviously, with the Protestant churches and with the televangelists and with the religious right, they get labeled as fundamentalists. But clearly the last couple of popes have, by all reasonable definitions, have been fundamentalists and very conservative.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, we have done that at Catholics. When I was at Catholics for Choice and continuing since I left, I mean, we really are very much, those of us who see this as fundamentalism within the Catholic Church are very much engaged in interfaith efforts of anti-fundamentalist groups. I mean, I've been part of those efforts for quite some time, and it is fundamentalism. And from my perspective, you know, I think what we haven't talked about really is women in this conversation, and he has not yet talked enough about women. But one of the hallmarks of every fundamentalist religious group is indeed the degradation and the demeaning of women as equal to men. And this has been the, you know, a major problem within the church. And it remains to be seen, although I am giving him all the time in the world, it remains to be seen whether Francis will take on the woman question as well as he's taking on certainly the LGBT question.
But it does seem that he's taken on the question of the ultra-conservatism and fundamentalism in the sense
that
he said that some people had assumed that he was an ultra-conservative. And he says in this interview with the Jesuit magazine America, but I have never been a right winger. It was my authoritarian way of making decisions that created problems. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think that that's true. I think the other side of this, of what he said, which we're not paying as much attention to, is that he said that the church has to pay more attention to some of those other issues that you know, when he talks about, they want me to talk more about abortion, they want me to talk about the rules, he says, nobody's going to trust us on those issues, basically, he says. Nobody's going to trust us. And if we want to gain people's trust, we're going to have to deal with, although he didn't mention these specifically, things like the environment, things like human rights, things like poverty. We have to get with it on the issues that really matter in a big way to everyone in the world. I mean, I'm not meaning to say that issues like abortion or LGBT don't matter. They matter very much. But the overemphasis on those issues, I think, is over.
And Marian Dadi Burke, the Executive Director of Dignity USA, the leading organization for LGBT Catholics, their families, friends, and allies. What do you think about the Pope's head-on acknowledgement about conservatism and ultra-conservatism in the way that the Catholic hierarchy has evolved over the last several decades?
I think he's saying quite clearly it doesn't work. You know, he tried it. He thought it was the way to go. And he feels like it was a mistake in the way he led. And he talks about those who have said to him, you know, essentially, you're the decider now. And he says, no, I believe in consultation. And he makes it clear that, you know, this meeting coming up with the eight cardinals from around the globe is a first step. And that he fully, it sounds to me as if he also intends to involve the laity in that kind of consultation. You know, he says very clearly that the church is the body of Christ, the full people. And, you know, we're the ones who are out there living the church every day. And for us to be involved in helping to shape the polity of the church, the direction of the church as it moves forward, you know, would be truly revolutionary given what we've experienced over the last at least 30 years. And I think a very hopeful message to all of those who have felt disempowered in the church and who have seen control of the message of the gospel being wrested away from them by the hierarchy.
But isn't it pretty clear that the church's problems of late, particularly the sex scandals and the pedophilia and the enormous payouts that represent billions and billions of dollars, and the fact that a lot of Catholics have simply given up on the church because of the continuing scandal, and the scandals themselves compounded by the way that they were mishandled in a way that protected the priests and not the victims. And it would seem to me that at the heart of these problems are these doctrinal problems that Francis mentioned about women. I mean, if you ordained women and allowed priests to marry, wouldn't a lot of this stuff go away?
Well, I think some of it would, without any question. Although I think that, you know, we certainly have our share of conservative women as well as we have our share of conservative men. But I do think that you know, I mean, I've always felt that the answer, the way things are going to change in many ways relates to a married priesthood, and then eventually to women priests. But, you know, once we have married priests, contraception is going to be another sacrament. We're not going to have married men priests, you know, married to women who are not going to have access to contraception. And then the whole thing falls.
Right. And if their daughter gets pregnant, then
that's right.
They have to deal with reality.
That's right. Exactly. And so you know, there is a way in which on many of these issues, I mean, obviously, I think that women have as much of a right to be ordained as men ever be a right to be ordained. And maybe nobody should be ordained, but that's another question. But if we're going to have ordination, that once men in the clergy have to deal with women as wives, things change.
And Marianne Duddy-Burke, what's your reaction to the notion that at the heart of so many of the recent problems with the Catholic Church's sex scandals is the abstinence, the men-only priesthood? Clearly, it's not working out. Do you think that if women were ordained and if priests were allowed to marry, those problems would go away?
Well, I obviously think that the single-gender hierarchical structure of the church is enormously, you know, much behind all of these problems. And I think it also goes back to the issue of why the Pope hasn't said that much about women. I mean, living in this sort of society where they really don't have to deal with women on an equal basis, an intimate basis, a day-to-day life basis, and understand what are the struggles and joys and concerns and gifts of women, you know, wives, daughters, partners, colleagues, friends, they just don't know how to address the needs of half the population of the world very well. And that's a tremendous problem. And I really hope that that is a place that we start to see opening up very soon.
Well, but I guess the question then is to both Francis and to Marianne, if the Pope is breaking the mold, which he appears to be, at least rhetorically, and you've both said that he's not taking on the women's issue, but maybe he will, do you think that this could end up being a surprising and even radical papacy?
I think one does not want to be, after years of seeing such terrible problems, one does not want to become Pollyanna overnight. And so there is still a part of me that remains cautious and says, let's see how it plays itself out. But I think this every new signal is positive that really we could see some significantly radical change within the church.
Well, we'll see whether the cardinals have buyer's remorse. And I think both Francis Kissling, the president of the Center for Health, Ethics and Social Policy and former president of Catholics for Choice, and Marianne Duddy-Burke, the executive director of Dignity USA, the leading organization of LGBT Catholics, their families, friends and allies. I thank you both for joining us here.
Thanks, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Colin Black. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.